As we face one of the biggest travel weekends of the year, we're on the move with Transports of Delight.
Stories from the world's planes, trains, and automobiles. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll be peeking inside the plane cabins in elite class.
It has a bedroom with a double bed and a sitting room with a couch.
We'll also find inner peace on a cable car in Bolivia.
Flying high over the busy streets, you can hear the sounds of the city, but they're muffled by the distance and the glass.
Plus, the voice behind train announcements in Japan crushing the accents.
I'm Australian, mimicking a Canadian who was mimicking a British woman who was the original voice on the Shinkansen.
Also, international tag, anyone?
A guy in Slovenia offered to hide me in his house.
We're transporting you today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for spending part of your day with us.
If you traveled anywhere for the holiday, you probably noticed you were in good and sizable company. Thanksgiving is one of the busiest travel weekends of the year.
The stress of it all might make some of you nostalgic for when flying, at least, was a bit more civilized.
Time flies quickly when one is happy and comfortable. Tea time is always a treat on this airline.
Tea time on an airline. This Thanksgiving, we're enjoying some of our favorite travel and transportation stories from the more recent past. Escapism with relevance.
We start with what is, I gotta admit, the fantasy of flying in one of those first-class suites and a frankly breathtaking conversation we had about that exclusive space at the front of the plane. Travel industry analyst Henry Hartevelt started out describing the latest offerings from Qatar Airways. Its business class Q-Suite set a new standard in 2025.
Not only is it lie flat, but the center seats can be arranged. So if you're traveling with a group of friends or family, you can have two, three, four people together, dine together, watch entertainment together, just talk, relax. And of course, when you're ready to, you can sleep. And some of those seats can even be converted into a double bed if you're traveling with a partner or spouse.
So Virgin Atlantic is offering something called a retreat suite. What does that look like?
This is at the front of their business class cabins, and it is a larger seat, larger entertainment screen, and it gives you that much more space and privacy. And the game on long-haul airplanes is real estate. It's finite. The cabin is only so large. So if you're willing to pay more for that extra room, that extra space, airlines are going to sell it to you.
You know, it does not seem like there would be room on a commercial flight for showers or something resembling private bedrooms. How common are those?
They're very rare. Etihad built what they call the residence, which is a private apartment.
Wow.
It has a bedroom with a double bed and a sitting room with a couch. And it's intended for one or two people traveling together who really want to have the ultimate in privacy. It's more like a private jet experience. You have a dedicated cabin attendant. So airlines are focusing on their premium products because literally that's where the money is. The airline industry for years focused extensively on driving down costs, and cost is still very important. But airlines, especially since COVID, have recognized that by investing in premium products, people are willing to pay more for their flights. And the airlines are saying, great, we're happy to take your money. Here's a nice glass of champagne.
Are you saying that if a few select customers are willing to pay exorbitant prices for wild perks, that the rest of us can rely on normally priced tickets?
Correct. It's always been the case that the premium cabin travelers have, in one way or another, essentially subsidized some of the coach passengers.
Just curious, how much is that private suite you were describing on Etihad?
It depends on the flight, but like $30,000 or $35,000 or more per person, by the way, to go from Abu Dhabi to London.
If the wealthy want even more space and luxury, why wouldn't they just charter a private jet at this point?
Well, that's a fair point, because to charter a private plane to go from LA to Tokyo, especially if it's just for one or two people, could cost you $75,000 or more, maybe much more, depending on the type of the airplane. First class at 18 grand a seat looks like a bargain. It's all relative.
Henry, what perk is on your wish list that no airline has managed to deliver yet?
A good cup of coffee.
I mean, the simple stuff in life, right?
The coffee just doesn't taste great on the plane. I don't know what it is.
Travel industry analyst Henry Hartevelt runs the San Francisco-based Atmosphere Research Group. He's been speaking with us about the trend in the airline industry to expand premium travel. Henry, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Even high flyers have to worry about things when traveling abroad that they don't really have to think about at home, like currency conversions and time zone changes. But as our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reported this summer, some travelers have turned those annoyances into a game.
If you've ever had a rocky time traveling abroad, congrats. I'd say you're halfway prepared to play jet lag the game.
We're here outside Victoria Station in London because over the next 6 days, we're going to compete to see which team can visit the most European countries. Welcome to Hide and Seek Across Japan. We're the Seekers, we're in Tokyo, and Ben is...
Where am I, you ask?
The YouTube series is kind of like if The Amazing Race and Google Maps had a baby. And then gave that baby a one-way train ticket.
We've played hide-and-seek across entire countries. We've played tag across entire regions of Europe. We've done races from the top to bottom of countries. We've even done a race all around the entire world.
That's Sam Denby, who co-created Jetlag alongside two other 20-somethings, Adam Chase.
We sometimes say that we play board games where the world is our board.
And Ben Doyle.
There was one time where Sam and I traveled nearly to the top of Japan when we were supposed to go to the bottom of Tokyo.
Each season, the three of them take part in elaborate global-scale competitions that often involve navigating public transit. It's part strategy game, part documentary, and perhaps most interestingly, a masterclass in transportation logistics. According to Denby, the idea for Jetlag came from the group's own experience with how travel never goes according to plan.
So we were thinking, like, it'd be fun to almost, like, put us in the situation where you're, like, struggling to get from one place to the other for whatever reason, and you sort of just got to figure it out. And it turns out that that is decently entertaining.
The show has been a big success, and it's now Denby, Chase, and Doyle's full-time job. They have millions of viewers, and Doyle says they often hear from fans who try to recreate the games themselves.
I think that one of my favorite things to hear from our audience is that they have taken a concept that we have created and tried it themselves, and, like, in doing so have discovered parts of, like, the town or city that they live that they have never been to.
That's part of the appeal of Jetlag, as opposed to more traditional travel shows. Instead of just giving a highlight reel of the best tourist destinations, by virtue of the games they're playing, they often end up in far-flung towns, staying in random hotels, eating whatever food they happen to be near.
I just went to this cafe and pointed at stuff on the menu that I kind of recognized. And it's great. Oh, man.
Okay. They're giving us a kind of behind the scenes idea of what it's really like.
Brooke Erin Duffy is a professor at Cornell, where she studies social media and influencers. She says Jetlag is a sort of double whammy when it comes to attracting viewers. It both gives them a genuine, relatable travel experience while also gamifying everyday life.
Game content is one of these social media formats that has done well since the emergence of YouTube creators now 20 years ago.
These days, Duffy says, just about anything can be gamified. A sure shot for influencers to get a bigger audience. Where that can get dangerous, she says, is when advertisers start paying influencers for the content they create.
We don't know if the meal they just had was the most fantastic thing they've ever eaten, or if they've been paid, and that's all part of the mystique.
The team behind Jetlag, for its part, says they are not paid or comped to eat at certain restaurants or stay at specific hotels. In fact, where they go and who they meet, Chase says, are often entirely dictated by the game itself.
One time in a game of tag, a guy in Slovenia offered to hide me in his house.
And while capturing the attention of people scrolling YouTube is the ultimate goal, the Jetlag team says this is what they want to communicate to their audience. Even though travel is stressful, if you take a breath, try to have fun, and go with the flow, you'll be surprised to see where you end up and who might offer to hide you in their home. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Jeremy will be back with us again later in the show.
This next story from the transportation desk began with a small gathering of friends that gradually transformed into an annual tradition that now draws 6,000 people from almost 40 countries. In September, the world's Bianca Hillier went to the annual rally staged by WIMA, the Women's International Motorcycle Association.
At this year's 75th anniversary celebration in Maine, 160 women from 20 countries talk like old friends. Michelle Lampier is running the show as president of the U.S. chapter. She shows me around the rented-out summer camp where national flags hang outside of cabins.
There's New Zealand and Australia at that next cabin. There's a big yellow inflatable kangaroo. So that's where the Aussies are at. Yeah. You cannot miss them.
Flags for Japan, Scotland, and Uruguay fly nearby. Lampier says one of her favorite parts of these gatherings is seeing women from across the globe bond over motorcycles. Some of the women at the meetup have tens of thousands of miles under their belt, like Linda Bick.
I got into motorcycling when I was about 17 in England.
Since then, she's racked up 62 years on the roads and counting, riding everywhere from Moscow to Cape Town to Adelaide.
God knows how many countries I went through. Just meeting different people, you know, from the different cultures, it's amazing.
Then there are bikers who are new to the open road. Down by the lake, a group of women celebrates one of them.
Hey, everybody, on shore. Tara, right there, just passed her motorcycle license about 2 hours ago.
A couple of beers are raised in the air. I ask Tara why she chose to start riding.
Been through a lot in my life, and something I always wanted to do was ride a motorcycle since I was like 8, 9 years old. And 58 just hit me, and it was like, you know what? Life's too short. I'm going to go do it.
These international rallies are kind of like really cool conferences. There are guest speakers on everything from tips for riding and fixing motorcycles to exploring Mexico by motorcycle. While the bikers have different reasons for getting into motorcycles, they all love them for some of the same reasons.
I feel freedom.
Freedom, independence, doing control of yourself.
You know, and you're just like, hey, I'm a powerful woman. I'm a brave woman.
And you're living in the moment.
Yeah.
You can zone out any thoughts.
Yeah.
Because they're somewhere else, because right now you need to focus on the road.
Michelle Lampier says there are usually a lot more people at the international gatherings, up to 300 women. But holding this year's rally in the U.S. was an obstacle for some members.
There was some pushback from some of the Canadian members against attending just because of the political climate in our country and how their country has been made to feel. And we actually had specifically some members from overseas that are part of the LGBTQ community. And they did feel that they might be targeted and that maybe the U.S. was not as safe an environment right now.
Historically, some of the biggest organized groups of women riding motorcycles have been in the U.S. and across Europe. In other regions, it can be a lot harder to find a community. One woman at the rally named An says that's the case where she's from, in Vietnam.
Culture, yes. It's simple.
Motorcycles are seen for men, she says, and there isn't a culture of women riding recreationally. She now lives in Finland, though, where the Women's International Motorcycle Association has connected her with more than 300 fellow bikers. Another member named Marta shares a similar experience from Nicaragua.
When I started, it was like, no, no, you cannot come over here. This group is just only for men, blah, blah, blah. So that type of machismo, you can say, is very difficult in my country. But now, they love me.
Still, in other parts of the world, women face more than cultural barriers. For example, in Iran, there's no explicit ban on women riding motorcycles, but the law says motorcycle licenses can only be given to men. The Women's International Motorcycle Association hopes to build on the movement to change that. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Poland, Maine.
Our Thanksgiving Day homage to travel and transportation has miles to go yet. Just ahead, how to fly in style with your dog. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We started the hour with luxury plane travel for people. Now a story about the glam life for dogs. As growing numbers of people move out of the U.S., a cottage industry has grown for pet-centric charter travel. When reporter Jane Little moved back to her native U.K. from the U.S. this year, she spared no expense for her doggo, Ronan, and reported this story along the way.
So we're in the waiting area in the lounge, and there's about six dogs so far. Some of them slightly more excitable than others. Hey, Ronan. This is a first for me, flying out of Teterboro, New Jersey, with eight humans, 10 dogs, and one cat called Graham. Poor Graham must travel in a crate, but the dogs sit alongside their humans aboard a Gulfstream G4. It's a pay-per-seat service organised by Adam Golder, the founder of K9 Jets.
So the majority of our customers are relocating from one country to another, whether it's from the US to the UK, to Dubai or Canada.
And there's also quite a demand right now, isn't there? A lot of Americans and others leaving America and coming one way.
You know, we've certainly, our phone hasn't stopped ringing since the election in America. So we've, you know, pretty much all our flights from the US to UK and Europe are sold out.
Adam says the disruption to commercial travel from the COVID pandemic launched his pet charter business. Since 2023, K9 Jets has flown over 5,000 pets up front, and its competitor Bark Air is packed as well. It costs an average of $9,000 one way from New Jersey to Europe, but Adam says most of his clients are not millionaires, just attached to their pets.
It's perfectly safe to fly in cargo, but people are so... I've got a deeper relationship, I think, with their pets than ever before. And they don't want to put them in cargo because they're family. Then you wouldn't want to put a baby in cargo. You want to sit next to your babies in the cabin of an aircraft, and hence the demand for our service, really.
So who's this? Who've we got here?
This is Hudson, and this is Sarah. He's 12 and she's 11.
Yes, Sarah. Oh, yeah. We're going to be good friends.
It's never going to end.
He's so cute. And have you ever flown this way before?
No, we haven't, and they've never been anywhere. So this is their first big trip, but my daughter is moving to the UK.
Oh, so you're delivering them?
I'm delivering them, yes. Yeah.
Greg Powell is a retiree from upstate New York. And like the other passengers I met, he seemed, well, normal, not part of the super wealthy private jet set. Neither, by the way, am I. But I am very attached to my four-year-old golden doodle, Ronan. Others went to even greater lengths and expense to get here.
My name is Gloria Haynes. We weren't supposed to be on this plane. We were supposed to be on the Queen Mary that sailed last Saturday. And so we went through the process of applying for a pet health certificate. And our vet, I think, may have had some bumps along the way. And it did not come until the day after we were set to sail. It was so stressful and so heartbreaking. And
Gloria's husband set sail, and she and her dachshund, Piper, waited in New York for the paperwork and a flight. Almost all of us had a stressful wait for the US government to endorse the health paperwork because of the tight timeline and low staffing and the sheer volume. My vet said she signed 3 to 4 times as many travel certificates this year.
You will board first. Gregory, you will follow her. All right.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great flight.
All right. This is Gina, who's going to be looking after you, Ronan.
Hi, Rona. You're very cute. Can I see this face?
Gina Cope, who proves to be a dog whisperer, has flown pets across the Atlantic 3 times in 4 days.
They tend to be fairly well behaved, are they, on these trips?
Yeah, for the most part. Everybody has a great personality in their own living room, and then this is very stressful for them.
Gina brought drinks and sandwiches, nothing for the dogs who were on fasting for 6 hours ahead of the night flight, and everyone slumbered. She said it was the calmest group she's flown, and better than the last one.
I didn't have a very good experience on the last one.
Oh dear, what happened?
I had a little bite. Not through the skin, thankfully, and not through a hole in the pants, but as I walked by, the dog nipped my leg. They get a little testy, just like us.
We had a smooth and quick flight, 2 dogs cuddled up on the sofa, mine asleep on the floor at Greg's feet.
Welcome to England.
Yeah.
Furry friends.
I hope our paperwork's okay. What can they do at this point?
Send us back. In cargo.
And just like that, it's over. We arrive at London Luton, where officials check our pet certificates, and Ronan gets a doggy bag with a cookie and a soft toy bone. We'll need to save up if we ever want to fly back, but even then we may not get a seat, since there's growing demand. K9 Jets is booked for months and says it's to expand its routes next year. For The World, I'm Jane Little.
So those dogs sound like they're having a blast, but travel isn't for everyone. Experimental musician Brian Eno, he hates flying. In 1977, he was waiting for a plane at an airport in Germany when the incessant sounds of jet engines and cheesy pop music got him thinking, what should we be hearing?
And that is when he came up with the idea for an entire album called Music for Airports. Brian Eno said the sound must be as ignorable as it is interesting. Listeners found it soothing and meditative.
Well, this summer, Heathrow Airport in London was reminded that Brian Eno was onto something. The airport partnered with Grammy-nominated producer Jordan Rakai to create Music for Heathrow.
On top of ethereal sounds, you can hear flight announcements, jet engines, the luggage carousel. A promotional video from Heathrow says the soundtrack lets travelers tune into their trip before the plane even leaves the ground.
You see, to me, that sounds exactly like what Brian Eno was trying to get away from. Check out what these commentators on London's Talk TV had to say.
It's a four-minute loop created entirely from more than 50 sounds sampled from the airport's terminals and runways. It started playing on Tuesday of this week. And apparently it's going to run till the end of August. I mean, this is where we are in the world.
Someone's laughing all the way to
somebody at the airport's making fake airport noises to play to people at the airport who can hear real airport noises by being at the airport.
I feel like they could put a bit more effort into making sure that, you know, the power doesn't go down or...
That might be good.
Keeping planes running on time.
In fairness, the sounds are not fake. They're samples of the real thing. I get their point, though. So, Heathrow, I don't know, how about a loop of mountain stream sound effects? Because I don't think we need any reminding where we are.
Coming up, when you ride public transit, you get very familiar with the announcements that constantly play on the speakers. The bullet train in Japan has one of those beloved announcers. We meet the surprising woman behind the voice just ahead on this travel edition of The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. When you step onto a bus or a train, you often hear a recorded voice telling you which route you're on, where it's going, and what stop is next. Sometimes that voice is robotic and cold. Sometimes it is warm and reassuring.
In Japan, regular riders of the bullet train rely on a voice that is most certainly not robotic. Last winter, our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel went to Kyoto and met the person behind the 200-mile-per-hour voice.
When you first board the Tokaido Shinkansen, the bullet train as it's commonly known, you hear two voices. First, an announcement in Japanese. And then one in English.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Shinkansen.
That second voice has become the subject of fascination for locals and travelers from around the world, with Reddit threads about her smooth and calming tone. One commenter writes, the first time I heard it, it made me want to meet her so we could discuss global politics or Wittgenstein.
You are welcome to put your luggage on the overhead shelf.
Well, I did meet her.
I'm Donna Burke, and I am a voice actor and a singer, but I'm most famous for doing the voice on the Shinkansen.
We find each other at a crowded cafe in the Tokyo neighborhood of Nakano, where she lives. We don't talk politics or Austrian philosophy, but I do hear the unlikely story of how an Australian expat became the British-accented voice of the most famous train in the world. A story that begins with a classic hymn.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
When Donna Burke first moved to Japan nearly 30 years ago, she tells me, she started out as a wedding singer. And while Amazing Grace might be more associated with funerals in America and Australia, it was a hit at Japanese weddings.
They loved having Amazing Grace sung by a foreign singer, which denoted that they were sophisticated, cultured, they had money. It was romance, it was class.
And for Donna, it was an opportunity. She did 6 weddings a day, making $300 each. She got representation, got gigs singing for TV commercials, and eventually landed gigs voicing and singing for video games, including Metal Gear Solid, Silent Hill, and Final Fantasy. And along with all of that success came more success. As Donna puts it, she was in the right place at the right time. It was the 90s and early 2000s, and more difficult to outsource English language singers and voice actors through the internet. And Donna was here in Japan. Another stroke of luck came in 2004, when the woman who previously did the bullet train announcements, a Canadian, was moving away. JR Central, the company that operates the bullet train, wanted a permanent resident. So they had Donna try out. And they wanted her to sound just like the person who used to do it, who they also had sound just like the person who did it before her, a woman with a calming English accent.
I'm Australian, mimicking a Canadian who was mimicking a British woman who was the original voice on the Shinkansen.
And if Donna is anything...
Welcome to the Shinkansen.
She is a great mimic.
This is an Ozomi Super Express bound for Shin Osaka Station.
She got the job and has been doing it for the past 20 years. Yet despite being heard by people all around the country, because she's putting on an act, nobody really knows it's her.
No one ever stops me and says, you sound exactly like... Because if I did, Jeremy, I'd be talking like this, in a very motherly voice, with quite a smile, not too much of a smile, but a smile nonetheless. And it's very calming, and that's not who I am in real life.
As I get off my train from Kyoto, I meet Susie and Jim McQuillan, who are visiting from Perth with their 3 children. They're stoked to have taken their first bullet train ride together, and even more excited to learn that even though Donna sounds just like a Brit, she's one of their own.
I think the bullet train's awesome. Much better than plane.
Very nice way to travel.
Did you notice the voice during it saying, like, you are now arriving? Did you know that she's an Australian?
Oh, really? No! No!
Susie, who speaks Japanese, gets a little inspired after I tell her Donna's story.
I want a job as the person that translates and announces the stuff. So I need to impersonate the person who's impersonating the person who's impersonating the original. I can do that.
But if you ask Donna, she has no plans to give up her job as the most famous voice that nobody knows anytime soon. For The World, Jeremy Siegel, Kyoto.
In Barcelona, city planners have set aside big chunks of downtown to give foot traffic priority over cars. These areas are known as super islands. Pedestrians and neighborhood residents love them. Drivers, not so much. The World's Jerry Haddon hit the streets for this story back in May.
It's Ivan Ferreira's day off. The 28-year-old sushi chef reclines on a long wooden lounger, reading a book, barefoot in the sunshine, in the middle of a major downtown intersection. In most parts of the city, this would get you run over. But this is a super island. I usually go to the beach, he says, but sometimes I don't have the time, so I come here. It's great. There are bars and cafes all around and lots of trees, he says, and it all generates a feeling of calm. There are benches and chairs of all sorts to sit on and big planters with flowers and bushes. What makes this a super island, though, is that it's not just one intersection. They come in clusters of up to 9, all contiguous, connected by pedestrian priority roads. An island is an escape, says Carme Jimenez, a fashion industry exec. She's answering texts and drinking a coffee on a nearby bench surrounded by flowers. You go to an island to get away from your usual surroundings, she says. They're trying to achieve that feeling with these super islands, she says, but they're not there yet. Because this is, after all, still a busy, bustling city. Cars aren't banned on these islands, but if you do drive in, you end up feeling like you've made a wrong turn.
Okay, I am turning into a super island with the hopes of taking a shortcut to get to the other side of this neighborhood, and I will fail. Because, as my friend Alex puts it, landing on a super island is like when you're playing a board game and you're trying to advance squares. Land on a super island, it sets you back one.
You can't just cut across them. The narrow lanes for cars are all set up as one-way streets that keep forcing you left or right. So you basically end up dumped out where you started.
And I'm driving at about 6 miles per hour. If this were night, the rats would be passing me.
As for my friend Alex, his full name is Alex Fernandez Camps. He's a well-known designer of bicycles and was also an early advisor to the city on the super islands. You don't need to be an expert in urban planning to see how these work, he tells me. All you need to do is watch. We're sitting at the center of yet another island intersection. Next to us, kids are playing. I see 5 people roll past in wheelchairs, seemingly unworried for their safety. The few cars that do come in, like I did, move in slow motion along the periphery. It's not about prohibiting cars, Fernandez says. It's about ensuring that driving here is inefficient. The essence of this project, he says, isn't the outdoor furniture or adding more bike lanes. It's about restricting the flow of motorized vehicles. Because, he says, they kill through accidents, but also from the pollution they generate and even the noise. Check out the sonic contrast between off-island and on.
Off-island. On-island.
The city has 9 super islands done or underway. It wants dozens, if not hundreds more. Again, Alex Fernandez.
El respaldo social es difícil porque suele ser...
People are reluctant when you introduce change, he says, but a lot of the people who are really against these islands, especially business owners who feared less traffic, they've come around. Like Tony Roche, who owns an on-island fruit and vegetable store. I was skeptical, he says, because we have to load and unload merchandise, and you're not allowed to park in here. But they told us, if you're a business owner, you won't have any problems. And we don't. Besides, he says, now when he looks out the front door, he sees green and people hanging out. Before, all he could see were cars and trucks double-parked everywhere. Now, one of the few cars I see is a taxi. Driver Carlos Delgado has just dropped off some annoyed passengers. He says they accused him of taking a circuitous route to run up the meter. I have to explain to my clients that there are certain streets around here where you really can't enter, he says. You have to go all the way around, then circle back, etc. You used to be able to get to your destination much faster, he says, and clients don't like it. And that, he says, means customers are less likely to flag him down, opting instead to walk, which, if you're on a super island, is a joy for many. But opposition to the islands remains strong in some corners. In 2023, a group of business owners sued to have Barcelona's largest super island removed, arguing that it snarled downtown traffic. A judge agreed, ruling that the city did not follow proper planning procedures in creating the island. The case could take years to resolve. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Getting a car through some parts of La Paz, Bolivia? Good luck with all that. Not because of zoning, but because of the city's extreme topography. It sits way up in the Andes Mountains, nestled in a bowl-shaped depression on a plateau. So not just any kind of transit can work there. As Michael Fox reported from La Paz last spring, a cable car system has transformed how people get around.
1.5 hours.
That's how long it used to take Juan Carlos Plata to go to and from work along the winding, car-choked streets of La Paz. Now, 11 minutes. It's been really good for us. It's incredible, he says. It's calm. No one bothers you. You couldn't expect anything like this before. The cable car, or teleférico as it's known here, was a pipe dream for years. But then, with the financial boom of the late 2000s and early 2010s, then-President Evo Morales made it a priority. It was inaugurated in 2014. 200,000 people use it each day. You've seen the geography of La Paz, says José Victor Choque, who rides the cable car frequently. Mountains, up and down. So to have a direct mode of transportation, it's beneficial for everyone. It really saves time. And the price is right. 3 bolivianos, or about 30 cents. I spent a pair of days riding up and down across the city. I'll be honest, I had expected long wait times, like you see for gondola rides at ski resorts. There was none of that. There are lines during rush hour, but they move quickly. A new car leaves the station every 12 seconds. That translates into roughly 50 people a minute.
I'm on the, heading onto the orange line right now. There's a couple people in front of me. And getting on.
Everyone sits, the doors close. Seconds later, the car speeds up and out of the station. In some of the cars, people talk softly. In one of the rides I took, someone was FaceTiming. But in most, everyone's quiet. It's almost like a place of meditation or reflection. Flying high over the busy streets and mass of cinder block homes, you can hear the sounds of the city, but they're muffled by the distance and the glass. The cable car is also really practical, says Ibi, who only gave her first name before running to catch a ride. When there are protests and roadblocks, it used to be a huge problem, she says. Now, we just fly over them. Protests aren't the only thing the cable cars help people get around. The streets of La Paz flood often in the rainy season, which stretches from November into April. One half-hour downpour in late January overflowed worn-out sewage systems, choking traffic, and sending water shooting up from manholes. The cable cars and their passengers rolled on like nothing happened.
Amo mi teleférico. Sí.
I love my cable car, says lawyer Olivia Espejo, who uses it to travel back and forth from work each day. For example, right now it's raining, and you would never find a minibus on the street, she says. Instead, the cable car continues to run. That's a huge benefit. I am very happy, she says. Is there a negative to La Paz's cable car system? Anthropologist Carlos Revilla says yes.
Pero aquí fue carísimo, ¿no? Fue carísimo y se hizo, digamos, un poco a toda costa.
It was really expensive, he says. The costs were way over budget, and they had to raise some properties to build it. But on the other hand, says Revilla, something else happened that was totally unexpected. It's been breaking down walls in the city between the rich and the poor. Working class people from El Alto can go to the malls, he says. Upper class people from the southern region can go to the July 16th market and feel safe. So there's been this beautiful process of rupturing urban segregation, he says. In a country where everyone is divided over politics, the cable car is just about the one thing everyone can agree on.
Por suerte, no.
It's incredible.
Luckily, I don't know anyone that doesn't like the cable car, says 17-year-old high school student Ignacio Crespo. He says it feels good that in the city where he lives, he can enjoy the longest cable car in the world. It's not new technology, he says, but it's innovative and helpful on so many occasions. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, La Paz, Bolivia.
It is a sporting event I can't believe many people were asking for, but it happened.
Wow, now look at the crowds.
Look at the crowd.
Vienna hosted the first ever World Tram Driver Championship in September. That racket was captured by the official live stream on YouTube.
Teams of tram drivers representing 25 different countries competed while thousands of spectators lined the streets.
Some of the tram driving challenges were pretty straightforward, stopping, accelerating, and backing up smoothly. Others were a little more fun, like steering with a bowl of water attached to the front of a streetcar and trying not to spill it, or tram curling, pushing a smaller trolley and making it stop on a target.
Goodness. This is really, really exciting. This is such a tight race right in the moment.
The competition was neck and neck right to the end. Home team Austria knocked down every pin but one in tram bowling. You can use your imagination, which set up Poland to snag the title in tram curling. But no, their drivers failed to take the lead.
Austria is the champion. Austria is the first winner of the World Cup. The host of the first World Cup gets the title. They got it. Now look at that.
The head of Austria's team said he was overwhelmed and speechless after winning in his native country. No mention of a home team advantage. Maybe next year will be Poland's time to shine with the second annual World Tram Driver Championship slated for Warsaw.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're spending this Thanksgiving Day telling stories of transit in solidarity with all the folks who made fast trips to be with friends and family.
But there is another way to travel, slowly, very slowly. Friend of the show, Paul Salopek, is a slow travel expert. He's a National Geographic explorer who has been walking around the planet pretty much nonstop for 12 years.
And because he's exploring the Earth at the speed of his feet, he's able to get off the beaten path and relish the luxury of the unexpected. So Paul gets to see stuff you might miss if you travel by car, plane, or rail, like one desert village he visited in Ethiopia.
Dalifag is a pastoralist kind of resupply center. The local people around there were camel and goat shepherds, and I was going there basically for the water, because I knew it had a well. And I had in my mind that this would be kind of a fairly rustic outpost, maybe with a little shop that I could buy some noodles and whatnot. But what I found out is that it was crammed with pastoral nomads. And the reason was, it wasn't just offering water, it was offering electricity for them to recharge their mobile phones.
And your picture of what that looks like is pretty extraordinary. It's not cattle pulling up to a watering hole when we're looking at USB and lightning connections.
It was pretty remarkable, because what I was expecting was kind of a well with camels around it and guys bucketing out water using, you know, skin buckets. There was that. But what I saw instead were shops that had these rows and rows of wires with chargers on them. And these nomads were coming in, giving the shop owner their phone. He was plugging them in for several hours. The shepherds kind of sat by and had a tea waiting for their phones to charge. I met one guy, and these pastoralists, you know, they're dressed traditionally. They're wearing kind of a sarong-like wrap. They have a big knife stuck in their belt. He had his wrap filled up with dozens of mobile phones that he'd gathered from his neighbors to come walk into this electronic oasis to recharge.
How do mobile phones fit into what sounds like, you know, this pastoralist traditional nomadic life?
For them, you know, having a mobile phone, even if you're pushing camels around the Rift Valley of Africa, is mighty handy. Because before you had communications, and we're talking maybe just, you know, a generation ago, fairly recently, you were at the mercy of middlemen who were going to buy your animals at whatever price they determined. The mobile phone has given these pastoralists an amazing, powerful tool to actually find other bidders. So it's given them great economic power.
So another surprise, at least for me, was what you found in a suburb of Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. You take us into this unlikely area with grungy auto repair shops, and you get to this tunnel that takes visitors 40 feet underground and more than 100 years into the past. What's in the secret chamber at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what some people don't know, I mean, Georgia used to be under the Soviet Union, of course, is that one of the great dictators, one of the big strongmen of the Soviet Union, one of the guys who killed a lot of people, right, was Stalin. He was Georgian. So to my astonishment, I found that there was this house near the Imtavai River in the city of Tbilisi that had a supposed relic of his printing press, right, where he was involved as a young revolutionary, printing out anti-imperial tracts, leaflets, what have you. And so at the bottom of this tunnel, this vertical hole, was, a century-old printing press.
I mean, as you say, Joseph Stalin is so associated with the Soviet Union, we forget that he had this earlier life as a native of Georgia. I mean, he was printing out revolutionary tracts. What else was he doing in his youth there?
Well, you know, Stalin comes from a very poor family, a shoemaker. He wanted to join the priesthood. He wanted to be a poet. Those frustrations, plus the revolutionary fervor that was bubbling up in the Caucasus at the time, got him immersed into basically Bolshevik radical activity. And part of that process, he became a criminal. He was a bank robber. He started knocking off banks. And he went in and out of prison. He was very good at escaping from prison. He'd be put in jail, and a few weeks later, he had escaped out to rob another bank to fund his revolution.
The museum curator there, he's also a real character. What's his story?
Yeah, old Soso. I mean, here was kind of a middle-aged Georgian guy. And keep in mind, you know, when I walked through Georgia, they were about 20 years or so out of being under the Iron Curtain. And everybody was very happy to kind of be independent, having their freedom. But Soso was kind of a throwback, what Georgians would call homo sovieticus, somebody who looked back with nostalgia on the Soviet period because he had been sidelined economically with the advent of pro-Western democracy, capitalism. He was basically living, Marco, at the museum. The museum was kind of his house. And he claimed to be a former KGB agent, very proudly, when he discovered that I was American. He showed me a KGB card, which was a bit suspicious because it was printed in English.
Wow. So one last stop, and this one is more recent. When you walk through Western China in 2022, you describe walking through dense forests, and you come upon a farmhouse, and the walls were covered with artwork, huge murals showing an astronaut, a Mars lander, a UFO, solar systems, constellations. What is this place?
Not just one farmhouse, but Marco, an entire village. So yes, the whole village had this very bizarre cosmic motif going on, which was very mysterious.
What did residents in this village have to say about space exploration?
I interviewed three people saying, you know, what's going on? Why is this kind of like the Smithsonian Institute's space flight wing in rural Yunnan, except on farmers' houses?
Right.
They said, you know, some guy showed up in a van one day and said, can I paint some stuff on your houses for free? And we said, sure, why not? They could use a coat of paint. And he painted these astronauts floating on tethers out in orbit, the rings of Saturn, in vibrant, vivid color. And as it turns out, apparently a businessman from an eastern city in China had come to this place. He was an amateur astronomer. He noticed how dark the sky was in this part of rural Yunnan, and decided to buy a local school building that was abandoned because, you know, people are leaving the countryside in China and moving to the cities. He bought it for cheap, converted it into a guest house, and tried to start a business of kind of touristic astronomy, inviting in amateur astronomers to come look at the sky over this town called Gomigu. And that was his dream. So he basically implanted his dream on this entire village, which, by the way, its main product was potatoes.
Well, Paul, we've only highlighted a few of the unusual spots you've come across on your walk. I'm guessing there are many, many more. I'm curious, though, what does the element of surprise play in a walking trip like yours?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a recurring theme in my life and in my writing, is that surprise, serendipity is crucial to this project. I mean, very little is planned. All these places that we just, you know, marveled over were accidents. This is an accidental story project where we find stories along the trail, not expecting what's happening next in the next day.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek writes and photographs as he travels on foot around the globe. You can follow along at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, thank you very much, as always.
Marco, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Whether your travels this weekend are slow or fast, down the street or across the country, we wish you a very pleasant holiday. The World is produced by GBH and PRX. We broadcast weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Happy Thanksgiving, Carolyn. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.